word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Well, Duff moet.
Tea leaves read by a gypsy. Send me in search of you.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We return now to our special broadcast of Writers on a New England Stage with Eric Larson, author of four best-selling books, most recently In the Garden of Beasts. I spoke to Eric in front of a live audience at the Portsmouth Music Hall. You spent 3.5 years researching this book.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're a journalist. You're not supposed to get attached. I wonder what that experience was like for you. Such a dark time to spend all that time in that era.
Yeah, well, you know, usually I, as a trained journalist, I used to work for the Wall Street Journal and Time and so forth. There were always two of me, I like to think. You know, there was the good me, you know, who would recognize how sad an event was, right? And then there's the bad me that sat on this shoulder would say, God, this is great stuff. However, and that got me through, you know, all my books. I mean, and even Devil in the White City, people often ask me, well, you know, so dark, did it ever affect you? Well, no, it never did. But this is a different thing entirely. And I mean, by the end of the book, I was dealing with what I would refer to as a low-grade depression. My wife noticed it, my kids noticed it, probably my dog noticed it, you know. And it was really starting to wear on me. You know, the whole book took, you know, maybe four and a half years, and 3.5 years of research is about right, you know, with a blend of writing thrown in as well. But when you spend that kind of time steeped in Nazi pathology, it really gets to you, you know. And the thing that kind of put me over the edge toward the end of the book, I decided a new book had come out. It was Richard Evans's The Third Reich at War. Terrific book, huge, huge. And I read that book just because I wanted to be up, you know, as up as I could be with current scholarship. And it was that book that really did put me over the edge. In particular, the revelation to me that even after the German army, even after Hitler, even after the Reich knew that they were losing the war, as they were retreating from the Soviet Union through the Eastern countries, the SS engaged in the systematic deportation of Jews from the towns that they passed through on their way out. The idea being Hitler's twisted idea that he wanted to save future generations from having to deal with the Jewish problem. And so it was just this idea that the war is over and they're still systematically deporting Jews to the death camps. It's just, you know, it's just, wow. It just put me over the edge. Happily, when the book was done, no depression. Gone.
Well, we all know what happens, right?
We all know what happens. We all know what happens.
But yet the book still reads like a thriller. And I wonder, after spending all that time, you have any new perspective on, you know, how could we do it? Why did the U.S. appease the Hitler government?
Well, but you see, nobody really understands appeasement. One thing I will say, though, is that people blithely use the term. But, you know, it was a very, very complicated thing. And once again, going back and looking at the world through this point of view. I'm not saying appeasement was the right thing. It certainly was not. But in many ways, it was the only thing. I mean, you had Britain on the one hand that had lost a generation of young men and was still dealing with this pall of grief and loss. And nobody wanted another war. There were moments when had Britain and France and Poland, which, by the way, was considered by the Third Reich, by the army of the Third Reich, to be a pretty dangerous foe in 1933-34. If they had stepped up at almost any point and moved against Hitler, they very likely would have prevailed. But it's pointless to even imagine that because it didn't happen.
Another interesting fact, there's so many in your books, obviously, but the State Department and FDR were so hesitant to say in frank terms how they felt about Hitler when a statement like that really would have made a big difference. Dodd's friend, Assistant Secretary of State Walton Moore, put it another way.
You're talking about the.
He said, you know, we're lynching Negroes here in the U.S. How can we say anything?
Well, actually, and that was a very telling moment because there had been a senator from Maryland, Millard Tidings, mm-hmm. had tried to pass legislation, introduced a bill to force Roosevelt to speak out against the Third Reich. And Walter Moore did a little investigation to sort of determine, was that a wise thing? What did that, you know, what would that achieve, and why maybe it shouldn't be done? And he concluded, you know, in a public document, he concluded that one reason you don't necessarily want to do that is because we have a lot of skeletons here, in particular in Millard Tiding's own state, where lynchings of black Americans were fairly commonplace. It was a really interesting document.
I use Negroes as the contemporary term,
yes,
obviously.
Yes, point of view, very important, point
exactly.
of view.
Exactly. A lot of people are wondering, you know, was Dodd up to the job? FDR really wanted an exemplar of American values. He wanted a Jeffersonian, and maybe Dodd thought that he could reason with Hitler.
Two responses to that. One is that I think Dodd did exactly what Roosevelt's mandate was for him. When Roosevelt and Dodd met in Washington before Dodd set out, Roosevelt told him he wanted him to serve as a standing model of American liberal values. Now, Dodd took that perhaps to extremes, you know, bringing his beat-up old farm Chevrolet to Berlin to drive around as a way of sort of demonstrating his own frugality to the world, and also being as a gesture in sympathy with Americans who were, you know, reeling from the Depression. But I would say in the end that Dodd has been given short shrift by historians. He was in an untenable position, an absolutely untenable position. A more traditional diplomat probably would have sought to kowtow to Hitler and so forth, and would have thrown elaborate parties and had Goebbels and Goering and so forth. Goebbels, by the way, was a much sought-after guest at the parties you threw because in 1933-34, because he had a great sense of humor. A vicious sense of humor, but he had a great sense of humor. But I would give Dodd, I would give him a B+. Mm. I really would. I would give him a B+. And frankly, you know, anybody who at the end of his life is hated by the Nazi leadership must have done something right. Mm. And, you know, they mocked him on his deathbed. They mocked him on his deathbed. And I think that's not a bad way to go.
You use some of Dodd's diaries as some of your sources, obviously a wealth of information there, and also Martha's memoir.
Yeah.
So how did you decide what to trust and what not to trust? I mean, obviously they wanted to show that they'd done a good job.
Right, yeah. You know, neither document was wholly trustworthy, and you could never use, you know, for example, Dodd's published diary alone, nor could you use Martha's memoir alone. But when you triangulate the material in those works with their papers in the Library of Congress, you know, as I mentioned, Martha has like 70 linear feet of papers and even her baby book, you know, things like that. And Dodd has probably twice that at the Library of Congress and probably three times that in terms of official correspondence reports and so forth at the National Archives. When you do all that, when you gather all this stuff together, you get a pretty good sense of what's trustworthy and what's not. One real danger with her memoir, for anybody who was foolish enough to just use it, is because, you know, first of all, it was published in 1939, and she omits entirely a very key character in her life and in the book, Boris Vinogradov, her great love, and I don't know if I want to give that away, but...
Yes, didn't Ambassador Dodd write in his diary every night with his stewed peaches and what?
Well, he did in fact prefer stewed peaches to big parties, and he once boasted that he could throw an entire diplomatic function with a single bottle of gin.
Terrific questionnaire from the audience. In this century, psychiatry has taught us about the unreliability of eyewitnesses. Do you think this is an obstacle for today's writers of history have to overcome, or does it make you more open to questioning and aligning alternate points of view?
Well, you know, I think, let me address the question this way. I mean, you always have to make judgments about what's trustworthy and what's not. Eyewitness reports are often untrustworthy. Eyewitness reports passed down to grandchildren, subsequent generations, are deeply untrustworthy. And the way around that is when you have an eyewitness giving you some kind of a report, you triangulate. You try to find corresponding or confirming reports, or if you have something that is deeply, deeply contradictory, then you can provide that viewpoint as well. But that's just the way life is. I mean, that's what makes, you know, lawsuits go around.
Henry O'Shaughnessy, I think it is, said, if you had to do a book report on this like I do, what do you feel would be the most important aspect to highlight?
I'm not going to help you. But I give you points for cunning. I really do.
I think he can maybe figure it out from the evening. This question relates to your book, The Devil in the White City, which I loved. If I were to go to Chicago, which places mentioned in your book are ones I should not miss seeing?
Okay. The Blue Crab Lounge. But that has nothing to do with the fair. It just makes great drinks. My favorite place. I'll tell you about my favorite place. There's lots of places to visit in Chicago. I mean, apart from the most beautiful and compelling thing about Chicago is Lake Michigan, which is a character, I think, in the book itself. But there is a cemetery to the north end of Chicago, Graceland Cemetery. And that, to me, was really the most most powerful single thing, because I'd done all this research, I'd gotten into the characters, all their relationships and so forth, and you know, whenever you do historical research, especially about something as fundamentally strange as first of all, as the serial killer, and second, I mean, the fair itself, which is such an amazing thing, I felt like, you know, did this stuff really happen this way? And I needed little bits of, like, grounding. And so when I went to Graceland Cemetery, and way at one end, a lot of the principals in The Devil in the White City are buried, not the killer, but, you know, Burnham and so forth and Root. And I just had the most profound sense as I walked through there in one lovely, lovely afternoon of all these people just standing around talking over cocktails. They were all there, and they were all there sort of in relation to their social hierarchy. You know, the Palmers had their Athenian temple on a mound, and then there was Burnham on his own little island in a pond. You know, dead, of course, but it was a very powerful moment. It just put it all together for me.
I asked you earlier if you would talk about the book that you're working on now, and I imagine you get so deeply into something, do you just have to move on?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, that's why you can never ask me too many detailed things about, for example, Isaac Storm, because, you know, I mean, God, that's like 15 years old now or something like that. I mean, I get so tied up, so caught up. I mean, people sometimes refer to it as immersion research or whatever. But suffice it to say, I get so caught up that there's nothing left for remembering anything else. People often ask me, you know, would I do a foreword to one of my own books? And it's like, no. I mean, I'm done. I'm often asked, will I do another, you know, would I ever want to do another book about, like, you know, the 1933 World's Fair, whatever year it was? And it's like, no, you know, I'm over.
Maybe Henry O'Shaughnessy could help you out with a book report somewhere.
Maybe, along
the way. And actually, that answers another question somebody asked, that, you know, I found your story about anti-Semitism in the U.S. even more compelling than the better-known situation in Germany. Would you ever write that story?
A story about American
anti-Semitism?
Well, you know, I would write the story, but the key word there is story, you know. What is the story, and how do you tell it? Because again, I have to emphasize, I'm in this for the narrative power of history. That's what I'm trying to do, and by doing that, I'm trying to give us the experience of these past events in as rich and powerful a way as I can. If there were a story that met all my criteria that would help me explore anti-Semitism in America in that period, I most certainly would. And in fact, I do have an idea, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. But that might be something I will do for a future book, but not this next one. I don't want to be typecast in any one territory.
You know, of course, after the Second World War, never again was the vow.
Right.
And now we're seeing or hearing reports anyway of people being just mowed down by the government in Syria.
Right.
You know, we saw it in Sarajevo. Right. We saw it in Sierra Leone. What do you think, you know, when you're doing this kind of research, are we living through the same thing?
No, but maybe. You know, it's such a complicated thing. I mean, there have always been these awful things. I think we know about them more vividly today because we have, you know, almost of the moment coverage, both online and otherwise. Is it any worse than it's been? Not yet. I mean, if I had to put my money on the worst evolving situation right now, I would definitely choose the president of Iran and the Iranian question, you know, the whole, are they or are they not building a bomb? And it doesn't really matter if they're building a bomb or not. They've essentially, you know, sworn to exterminate Israel if they get a chance. You know, do we take that seriously, and how seriously, and what do we do about it? You know, it's so complicated. I'm going to go on a limb here. I'm going to say that I think Roosevelt had it easy compared to Obama, you know, and in respect to that particular situation.
What an amazing book, and I so look forward to the next one.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to the next one, too. But you guys were great. Really terrific. Thank you.
Eric Larson there during his book tour for In the Garden of Beasts for the Writers on a New England Stage Series. The series is presented by Portsmouth Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio in collaboration with Yankee Magazine and River Run Bookstore. Executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. New Hampshire Public Radio president is Betsy Gardella. Our broadcast producer for today is Taylor Quimby. Associate producer and communications director for the series is Margaret Talcott. Associate producer is Tom Holbrook of River Run Bookstore. The live sound and recording engineer is Mike Marchand. Musical director and band is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. To hear other authors from the series, visit nhpr.org and click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.